Excellent. Okay, this is Elisa Permain, and I have the honor of introducing Jenny Cargill Strong. And Jenny is one of the HSA Executive Committee members. She's been a member for how many years, Jenny?
I don't know. I don't count well.
But longer than I have, so at least 4 or 5 years probably.
Okay. Yeah, wow. Yeah. Time flies, doesn't it, as you get older?
Jenny, in case anybody missed it, is from Australia, and it's now, what, about 11 in the morning over there?
It's 11 in the morning, yeah.
Yeah, excellent. So we appreciate you.
And it's winter.
Oh, it's winter. Wow.
Yeah, but we don't have the kind of winter you have where I live. I live on the east coast of Australia. So if you imagine the map of Australia and the part that sticks out, the furthest, the most easterly point of Australia, that's where I live. It's a place called Byron Bay where the whales swim past, and it's got very spectacular bay and beautiful volcanic caldera, and it's very green. It's a very biodiverse region. It's a home of all sorts of alternative ideas and spirituality and kooky people too, and creative people and runaway artists from the city. And yeah, it's a very colorful place, and it's a great place to be a storyteller. I feel very embraced here with any kind of an alternative idea that I want to bring through my stories. Yeah.
Well, and that relates to some of what you'll be talking about tonight. This is an expanded repeat of something we did in April, in which we didn't get to do the full evening. So, but what we heard last time was really inspiring to me. Jenny shared stories from Joanna Macy and talked a lot about sense of place and how to use that to bring about more environmental awareness and love of the land. And Jenny is a wonderful storyteller, I know, because I've worked some with her on some storytelling CDs that she did, and she's been very active over in Australia with protesting and what she calls protecting the land against gas mining and other environmental things that are going on. So I'm very excited to have you back, Jenny, and to share with us your stories and your wealth of wisdom. And I will mute myself and take it away.
Thank you, Elisa. And I just feel so overwhelmed to hear that from you, because you're all my heroes. So so it's very heart-opening and humbling to be acknowledged that way by you guys, and the Healing Story Alliance has been such an enormous part of my journey. And Fran, I'm getting all emotional now, because sometimes here I can feel a bit alone. I did manifest and build a storytelling network for a little while here. Once my kids were of a certain age, I kind of threw myself into manifesting a circle of tellers, and that took a few years, and then it lasted for about 18 months, and it's evaporated a little bit. But I'm just about to launch a new series of story concerts where I really want to build that in a much higher degree. But the reason that I needed that support was I didn't have many storytellers near me, because I'm not in a metropolitan area. Because this is a very highly anthroposophically, there's a lot of Steiner schools here. There's a lot of people who understand the value of stories and do tell stories, but not many people who would actually call themselves storytellers as such. So for me, in all those years, with or without the circle of tellers that I had before, the Healing Story Alliance has been enormously important and vital for my growth and my journey, and incredible generosity with which the members of the group have shared their wisdom. And Fran also has mentored me in how to teach environmental storytelling. And luckily, years ago, the director of my drama school said to me, look, if you want to learn something, a great way to learn something is teach it. And if no one else is teaching it, we'll step up and teach it. So when I looked around Australia and thought, well, there's no one teaching environmental storytelling, what can I do? Maybe I'll ask Fran if she wouldn't mind helping me. She was so generous. Fran was just so wonderfully generous and shared materials that she'd crafted over, a long period of time and honed. And the same with Elisa. When I saw Elisa's book, I fell in love with Elisa's book, Once Upon a Time, and it was enormously valuable to me in my life, supporting my daughter, who was being very badly bullied at the time, which is what motivated me to start telling stories from it. And then as I told more of those stories, I fell in love with them so much that I decided to create a double album. And Elisa, again, was very supportive and encouraging and just beautiful to work with. So all hail to the Healing Story Alliance for your big, big hearts, and also for Alison holding my hand when I've been a bit traumatized by tech hitches and things. So it's a great relief to finally be on the call at the right time. So I just, because I've had a slightly jangling morning in more way than just technology, I would like to just take a little moment to just to slow down and have a little short guided visualization, which I feel helps me to get into that part of my in my heart, and it's a part of the work that I'm doing as a duality facilitator, which is a process I'll talk about later. It's a way of helping people using kind of despair and empowerment processes from deep ecology to help people move through any despair and discouragement that they're having about the state of the world and the environment, and moving through to the flip side of those shadow feelings into empowerment and into action and to connection. So I feel that this is important just to take a little moment. And I'm sure many of you would be aware of the Celtic world tree, and I just want to visualize that for a moment. The Celtic world tree that had its roots deep, deep down under the earth. And the Celts believed that that was that connected to the underworld, or the world of, some would say the shadow side would be, you know, the dark ghouls and the scary things, and others would think of that underworld place as a place of dreams and visions and unborn things that have yet to come into fruition on the ground. And then the world tree with its deep, deep roots rises up into the trunk of the tree, into the earth, into the realm that we all walk upon. And this is the realm of the ego. And this is the realm of doing things and bringing those dreams into fruition. And as it rises up into the heavens, and the great branches stretch up, up, up into the heavens and take that energy from the earth, from deep down in the earth, and take it right up into the heavens. And in the Celtic world tree, there is also a fourth layer that goes even above the sky kingdom, where the beings of the sky kingdom, the gods and the goddesses and the energies and those angelic energies live even higher. They live ordinarily in the realm up above that. That's my rough understanding of it. So just with a quick summary of that, I just want to lead us into taking a few deep breaths, because I need this also. So I'm going to ring my little singing bowl and hope that it sounds okay through my telephone, and then just lead us through a very brief little guided visualization just to sink into nature and reconnect us. So just taking a few deep breaths in and out. And with each in-breath, becoming more present. And with each out-breath, letting go of any hurrying, any rushing, any frustration, anything that pulls you out of the present moment. And another deep breath in your own time. And breathing out. And now allowing your body to find a comfortable position. For me, I'm standing because I want to really feel the tree. But if you want to sit comfortably and just imagine this, as we imagine our feet digging down, down into the earth and reaching deep, deep under the earth, into the darkness of the earth, where the earthworms live, where the rocks and the soil and the deep water, the deep, clean water that lives, that's lived there forever. Tapping into the purity of that ancient resource that's been here since the world first formed and the first oxygen appeared and the first water appeared. That water is the same water that appeared long before humans ever arrived. And allow the roots of your tree to be curious about what's underneath. Perhaps the roots of your tree can smell, can taste, can sense as they push through the earth, through the rocks, down to drink the water and to take in nutrients from the soil. Just feel how it feels to be so deeply rooted. So calm, so grounded. And then with each in-breath and out-breath, allow yourself to imagine that your body is turning into the trunk of this great tree, this beautiful, ancient tree, so strong and yet able to sway in the wind as the wind comes and blows you without cracking, just giving and swaying, but ever so rooted and grounded with that massive root system underneath you. And as your trunk grows up, up, up towards the heaven, you feel your branches reaching up. And in the branches and in the hollows and in the cracks of this tree dwells all manner of creatures. Lichen and moss grows on this tree. Birds come to feast on the insects that live in this tree. Microorganisms dwell in the roots below, inside the tree, outside the tree, all over the tree. Imagine all the buzzing life that you are supporting. And as you breathe in and out, your respiration goes into the atmosphere, cleansing what needs cleansing and nourishing you with what needs nourishing. Feel your magnificent trunk swaying gently in the wind and hear the sound of the insects living in your branches and the caress of the wind on your leaves. Perhaps you are covered with leaves. Perhaps you have just dropped your leaves. Perhaps you are budding with flowers. Perhaps there is honey in the flowers and there are bees attending you. Imagine now as your breath goes in and out. With no rushing, there's nowhere to go, you're a tree. Imagine your tree stretching up, 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 higher until the branches of the tree tickle the belly of the sky. And you can look up from that height, you can see above the clouds. You can even stretch higher and higher, perhaps like the Celtic world tree, to a huge viewpoint. An aerial viewpoint to see the world from this calm, calm, wise place. And as you flow, the energy flows from the earth's roots right up, 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 up to the branches at the very tips of your outermost reach, right up into heaven. And that beautiful, sweet, angelic energy in heaven flows back down, down through your trunk, down through your leaves and branches, through your trunk, to the roots, and this endless exchange. As you calmly breathe in and out, as you gently sway in the beautiful caress of a gentle breeze. Just take a few more breaths in and out as that tree. Drawing on the strength of those roots, the strength of that trunk, the joy of being part of a complex web of life, and the feeling of the sunshine on the top of your branches. And on the last breath, you can either choose to slowly come back out of treeness and into your own body, maintaining that sense, that solidness of the tree, the gentleness and the quiet and the wisdom of the tree, the resilience of the tree. Or if you want to, you can stay as the tree while you listen, if that works for you. Either way, bring yourself back to your body and your room as you feel is right. I'm going to ring that singing bowl again. So, this is the kind of thing we do in Byron Bay and Mullumbimby a lot. So it gives you a little sense of the place that I'm in. And I use that meditation in the walking tour that I do along the coastline. I take tourists. It's just a new business, so it's just picked up, picking slowly, building, and I'm in recess for winter. But because I felt that it was very important to connect people to place, and because I'd been to Hawaii and visited Jeff Gehr, many of you will know Jeff Gehr, and they did such a beautiful ritual and such a beautiful welcoming. And I can't personally, as an Australian person, I can't access Aboriginal rituals myself and use them. I can invite an Aboriginal person to come and do welcome to country, but I can't. I can do acknowledgement of country, which means saying, you know, I acknowledge that this is the traditional custodians of the land, the Iroquois people, or the Bundjalung people, or the Gidabil people, whoever, wherever I am, and I can say, and I am grateful for their custodianship of this land and for keeping the traditions of this land, for protecting this land, and I acknowledge and thank ancestors past, present, and emerging. But that's really as much as I can do as a non-Indigenous person here. I haven't got an Australian welcome ceremony that is as beautiful as I've experienced in Hawaii, where we were blessed and we were welcomed and we had leis put around our head. And so I thought, what can I do? So what I did was I do this tree meditation to help people enter that liminal space, that altered space, so that they can listen to my stories in a different frame of mind, because I think ritual is so important. Even lighting a candle, we all know about that in story. You all probably use ritual. And so I've been just expanding outside of... I don't actually use traditional openings and closings like crick crack and things like that myself. It doesn't. I love it when other people do, but it's not something that comes naturally to me. I wove it in my Reaching for the Moon CD, but I haven't used it so much. So I use this meditation in various formats in different ways, depending on how I feel on that day and what I'm sensing with the people that I'm with, to help ground people and connect people to earth. Because the way I tell the stories that I tell to tourists as they walk along the beautiful foreshore of Byron Bay, which is actually quite a tourist destination, it's quite busy, I'm trying to connect them to that deeper place that's still there underneath the concrete. It's not concrete everywhere, but there is a bit of concrete underneath the hubbub, underneath the noise, and reconnect to the beauty of nature and the ancient feelings of it by taking them back in time. The first thing I do is I take them back in time to imagine what the place would have been like through time. And we go right back millions of years before any humans had arrived, long before the Aboriginal people arrived, and we think they arrived between 60 and 80,000 years ago. Some people say much longer ago. But back to 15 million years ago, when the landscape was shaped into the beautiful bay form that it is now, and forward to the last ice age, and just get a sense of how that beauty, I hope to engender a sense of guardianship in the way that Aboriginal people feel that custodianship. I hope by telling stories of place that I will invoke that sense of guardianship and love and deep connection and a sense that we are a part of all. We don't need to reconnect nature. As I was saying at the climate change rallies recently that I think Elisa and many of you attended, we are nature. That's what they were saying at the Paris Climate Summit, wasn't it? We don't need to reconnect nature. We're not defending nature. We are nature defending itself. So this is moving into a radical place. So the stories that I want to focus on today, I want to give you a little overview of the kinds of things that I'm doing. I know that you're all the people listening are doing rich, wonderful things yourselves, but just to give you an insight into what I'm doing so that when we have the question and answer, you can ask about anything you like. That's one of the things that I'm doing is these story walks. And the next project that I'm doing is I'm starting an evening called Storytelling in the Club, because there's this movement here of storytelling in the pub in other cities. It has different names, but in my town of Mullumbimby, which is a fairly small community, but it's a very active community, we have politics in the pub already, which is led by a local think tank, where people hear visiting speakers who speak about neoliberalism and unpacking neoliberalism. And then we've got art in the pub. So I realise, you know, there's this tendency for people to come to the pub and actually focus, which is a new thing. In Australia, people just generally go to the pub just to drink, and it's not that kind of a focused environment. But because this has built up. Now I feel like there's an opening for me to build this in my community. And I've also begun learning, and I know that many of you who've worked in social work and various community organizations will already be aware of this, but this is a new thing for me, that it's incredibly valuable to build partnerships. So before last year, I led for about a year quarterly concerts called Golden Tales, which are all about stories of place. And that was also what I was wanting to create, as I said before, that whole idea of invoking not only custodianship, but also knowing that you can't defend a place unless you're really united as a community. So I wanted to also have it as a community building thing where people come and share stories from the heart about their place, fall in love with their place, and also meet each other so that they feel bonded. But now I feel that was lovely. We had 30 to 60 people attend, and now I want to ramp it up. So I've been involved in a local group called Creative Mullumbimby, which is it's focused on the arts and fostering the arts in our town. And it started by making a sculpture walk outdoors with place-based sculptures. So the idea is that the artist can't just, it's not plonk art. You can't just take a piece of art and plonk it in a site. You have to actually go to that site, research that site intellectually, historically, and then you have to feel into that site. What makes sense in that site? What is that site saying to you? How do people use that site? And so because I've been a part of that group, I've been thinking a lot about place-based storytelling, but I've also learned a lot about partnerships, community partnerships. We want a really big grant beyond the strength of having many community partnerships. So what I'm doing with this new storytelling night, storytelling in the club, because the pub won't let us go there, we have to go into the local RSL club, I'm making it stories of place and stories of hope. But I'm widening the sense of place because I found that it flummoxed people when I made it so narrow as to only make it our local region. I found that that made it not difficult for everyone, but sort of limiting for some people. They couldn't necessarily think of a story from their own region about deep connection to place, which is something in itself, I guess. But I've just made it stories of place generally. So it could be that you really bonded to a place, you know, in Italy when you were visiting there, or it could be that you're talking about the homeland that you had before you moved here. There's a lot of people who move here from other places as well. And from that to extrapolate to people's sense of place here. I think that mostly stories of local place will emerge. But the second part of it is stories of place and stories of hope. Because if anyone is an activist, if anyone's got their eyes open, we certainly live in challenging times, don't we? And we can discuss this more when we open up to question and answer and discussion. But, you know, to keep our heads up and to keep empowered, I feel that stories of hope are phenomenally rich soul food. And I had a few technological snafus again. It's something about the teleconferences seems to bring them on. My computer died, and so I can't access some of that information. You don't need the bio of that. So that's the concerts that I'm doing. And Alyssa also mentioned that I was a part of the Bentley campaign. And that was to stop unconventional gas mining, which is still an enormous threat here. The government is still pressing ahead and telling all sorts of bald-faced lies, actually, about how, you know, coal is good for humanity. And so we've got someone, you know, we've got people in Parliament who, our Prime Minister is actually quite smart, but he is being pushed very hard by the right to say all sorts of pro-coal things, which is distressing, and poll and pro-gas fracking sort of things. And even though it doesn't actually stack up economically, that's being pushed. So I'm very, very aware that the best story wins. But that wasn't so much on my mind when I was involved in the Bentley campaign. We had a very successful campaign, and there were all sorts of people trying to wrestle their way onto the microphone in the morning. So we would have these beautiful gatherings, which I might have mentioned last time. So I'm not sure if I did mention this last time, but we had these beautiful dawn services because we would get the message that the machinery was going to come in, that the our equivalent of the SWAT team was going to come in. This is the Special Security Police Force, who tend to be a bit heavier. They have riot gear and that sort of thing. They were sending they're called the Riot Squad. So it was a very, very tense time. And because there were so many people trying to get onto the microphone, the people who were the organisers were quite defensive about who could and couldn't get on. And I wasn't able to tell a story at the dawn service because it wasn't until it was almost over that my network all said, look, she's a professional storyteller, she's awesome, she will tell something that's suitable. But what was really an interesting experience for me in that process of just letting it go, that was one of the parts of the process, but the other part was that I was wondering what story wanted to be told. And you may have had this experience too, that when I started out storytelling, I would decide what story to tell. And I still do that in various contexts. I think, oh, well, given that context, given that audience, this age group, I'll probably tell that story. And then you turn up at the gig and another story asks to be told. And the experience that I had was that I was standing there at the dawn ceremony at Bentley, you know, this very excited atmosphere in a sense, because although we were under great threat, the skill of those activists was that they made it a celebration. So we had a dawn service in terms of we sang songs. We often had a local church minister who was very on side, who actually did, you know, a Christian service as well. We had, I think there were Buddhist monks came at times and did a blessing. We made it spiritual, they made it fun, they made it colourful, they had all sorts of celebrations. But nevertheless, there was this, you know, there was a lot at stake. We were happy, we were in solidarity, but we were nervous because we could all be hurt. So I'm standing there and I'm thinking, what story? And up came a story that completely flummoxed me at first. And it was the story of the woman who wouldn't tell her story. And that's the story that I have learned from Donna Jacobs-Seif. And she says that it's an Indian story, and I've heard her tell it many times. It's at her website. I wasn't planning to tell it today. I'm hoping that you're not. But the gist of it is, because I'll tell other stories in more depth, and oh my God, it's already half an hour and I've not even started telling a story yet. So the gist of that story is that there's a woman who will not tell her story, she will not sing her song, and she will not dance her dance. So Donna's expanded it. I think the original version was just about telling her story. And the journey is about her having a huge argument with her husband, and then in the end he says, you know, I just heard that, you know, the reason that you're so unhappy is that you're not telling a story, you're not singing your song, you're not dancing your dance. Why is that? And she just says, what story? What dance? What song? Because she can't hear them. They've been begging to be told. They've been racking her with terrible dreams and nightmares and keeping her up awake with cold sweats trying to get her attention. They try all these things to try and get her attention, and she won't pay attention. And I thought of that as a therapeutic story. I thought of that as a story to heal somebody who wasn't listening to their inner intuition, wasn't listening to their deepest longings. And I thought, I didn't see the relevance. And as it dawned on me and I watched the way that at Bentley people were connecting to the earth, we were singing the songs of the earth. Like, people specifically wrote stories to sing about Bentley, about what we were doing, and in solidarity with the earth and the water and the clean air. We were literally dancing the earth, singing the earth, and telling the earth story, because there was an amazing crew of quite professional media people who were constantly pumping out little videos out into the world through social media and telling the story of Bentley, because the mass media was painting us as silly rent-a-crowd activists who were just against things and getting in the way of jobs and progress. And we were able to get the other story out, that no, we were doctors, we were, you know, yes, there were a few committed activists, and most of us were farmers, doctors, nurses, and we were able to tell our story and get it out to the world. And when it hit social media and got a certain number of hits, then the mass media actually had to report on what we were doing. And so slowly our story began to be told. And that's when I realized that the reason that story wanted to be told in that context is because we were listening to the earth song, singing the earth song, we were telling the earth story, and so on. And so it suddenly became, for me, a story with a completely different level of meaning. So I'm aware that it's now 11:30 and I haven't even started a story yet. I don't know if anyone or Alyssa wants to make a comment or steam in a certain direction before I start telling a story. I have two long stories to choose from, so I may need to just choose one. We discussed during the Shambhala Warrior, which I did tell last time in brief and which I've reworked this time. And I've also reworked the beautiful, beautiful story by Laura Sims. It took me a long time to figure out how to... I haven't changed it much. I've changed it a very small amount, really. But she told it so, so beautifully and has woven and crafted it so very beautifully that it took me a long time to divorce myself from hers and make mine slightly different. So does anyone want to tell me which you'd like to hear at this point?
This is Elisa, and I'm going to give a plug for the Shambhala warrior story.
Okay, great. Yeah, cool.
People may have heard the other one more. That's my plug.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't need that again when we're short of time. So here we go. So I just want to give you a short introduction to the Shambhala warrior story. It's the kind of story that probably needs all the stuff that we've done already with a guided meditation, with getting easing people into a certain frame of mind. It is quite a radical story, I feel. So it'd be interesting in the discussion to see how you feel. And I suppose it's informed, the way that I tell it is also informed by my belief that you can't fix what's broken with the same thinking that caused the brokenness. So for me, I feel that what's required to address the environmental situation we're in is holistic. It involves everything. We need new ways of thinking, new kinds of stories, new ways of interacting with the earth, and new technology. It all needs to change. The whole social fabric needs our values need to shift very profoundly, and we can't just tinker at all. So that's where I'm coming from when I tell this story. And this story was brought, as far as I'm aware, it was partly brought to the West by Joanna Macy, who many of you will be familiar with, who did the work, The Reconnects. And she walked in a Peace Corps with her husband, and in Northwest India, she became a Buddhist, and she was speaking to her teacher, who was a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and he told her the story of the Shambhala warrior. And you can find the original, if you Google Joanna Macy and the Shambhala warrior, you'll hear her tell it and her interpret it, and that's really worth doing. And I came to this story when I began training in a process I made reference to before called Joyality. And Joyality has been written by a friend who's got a lot of experience with deep ecology called Ishana Bragg. She's got a doctorate in ecopsychology. And what she felt was that while the deep ecology was great and the work that reconnects was great, she was working with young environmental science students who were becoming so emotionally overwrought by the data that they were working with that they just couldn't cope. And, you know, I totally sympathize. When I've not done that to that degree, but I'm aware that, you know, environmental scientists really do it tough. And I'm just a regular person who looks at a certain amount of data, and I find it overwhelming. So what she wanted to do was to, initially her focus was to create a course that was manageable for young, her focus was young adults, because she also saw that not only were young adults suffering the greatest, they were the most depressed and the most prone to suicide, the worst suicide data, but they were also the ones that are often the engine room of massive sweeping changes. So, and I would add to that, I think that the retired generation, the two ends of the adult spectrum are the engines of a revolution, not a revolution, but a transformation. Revolution has some violent connotations. I'm not into that at all, but radical changes and shifts in culture and ideas. So Joyality is not about being happy all the time. She defines it as the quality or state of feeling deep and encompassing joy, a feeling of wholeness, oneness, and exuberance for life. And she calls it a program for empowering personal and planetary transformation. It's an 8-week course, and in that 8 weeks there's like a U-curve where you slowly work up to going down into your despair, down into your feelings of disempowerment. So rather than just putting a bright shiny face on it, you're actually looking deeply at the shadow and giving it room and giving it space to say what it needs to say and be and come out. And then you at that point you then flip it and look at what are the opposite of the shadow, what are the empowering aspects of that shadow that can then empower you to action. And so it's about being awake, connecting, and acting. And so then you go back up the you and back up to empowerment. And of course it's not a quick fix. It doesn't just work like that. You need to keep practicing all the practices that you learn to maintain that state and to also connect to community. So through Duality we're building, you know, a network of people who've done the training and understand that, who can continue to support each other. So that's probably enough introduction. Here is the story. And I'll start with a quote from Arundhati Roy. Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. the Shambhala warriors. 12 centuries ago, Buddhist monks in northwest India foretold that one day the earth would become wounded, her oceans and lakes sick, fish would be born deformed, and birds fall lifeless from the sky. Forests and plains would wither, and the survival of every organism on this gorgeous planet would hang by the finest thread. This state of affairs would have been brought about by two great barbarian powers who would squander their vast wealth on weapons and machines of unfathomable destruction. Though these two powers saw each other as enemies, they had a great deal in common. And at this time, the Shambhala warriors would arise. These warriors would wear no uniform or insignia. They would have no homeland, for Shambhala was not a place they could retreat to and rest within. Nor did they carry any weapons, no guns or bombs of any kind. Great courage, physical and moral courage, would be required of them, for they would penetrate deep into the very heart of the barbarian strongholds to dismantle the destructive systems from within. Now, when I first heard the word warrior in the story, I felt a little cool. The connotation for me of warrior was of power over, violence, pillaging, destruction, brutality, and even rape. But as I pondered this tale, I also pondered the positive attributes of a warrior. A warrior stays calm and steadfast in the face of fear. A warrior is disciplined, studies their opponent, and is strategic. A warrior defends that which is dear to them, even when it requires self-sacrifice. A warrior moves towards the enemy even when there is danger. And a warrior works in a team for a united and coordinated purpose. The prophecy described the Shambhala warriors as only being armed with compassion and insight. Compassion would give them the passion and the fire to take action, to step forward and defend all that they loved so dearly. But with that alone, they would burn out. Their insight balanced that heat, for it was cooler, and it was threefold. Firstly, they understood that the thread of good and evil runs down the center of every human heart, including, of course, their own. And also, that the radical interdependence and interconnection of all phenomena, or the deep ecology of life. And that this state of destruction on earth was brought about by manomaya, or human imagination, and I will explain those three insights. The first insight allowed the warriors to see beyond the duality of good and evil. And even though they did not shy away from naming destructive acts as barbaric or the people committing them as barbarians, it freed them from projection so they could recognize their own shadow and so be able to engage with those bringing about this dire destruction. That it is important to think and to study the systems we live within and withdraw or divest our intellectual, emotional and financial energy from these systems and transfer all of that to regenerative systems to replace the old as they fall, which is what is happening in a tremendous groundswell all over the planet. The second insight of the radical interdependence means that it is easier to hate, but much harder to love well, and especially to love one's enemy and have compassion for all. They had to not only understand the intricate and delicate web of life, but also the intricate and delicate interconnectedness of human systems. For science and systems theory tells us that all structures can collapse and that human societal structures are far less solid and stable than they may appear, and that just a small change in one part of the system can lead to a large ripple of change, which can become sweeping, radical change. The Shambhala warriors understood, therefore, the enormous power of even seemingly subtle actions. The third insight, that this horrendous destruction was not brought about by some alien force or even some irrevocable fate, but actually was born of manomaya, the human imagination. Since these problems were created by manomaya, they could also be undone with manomaya. Now, the prophecy did not specify how things would end. Joanna Macy says, if anyone tries to tell you how it ends, don't believe them. Be suspicious, because no one can know yet. And doesn't not knowing keep us engaged and working hard for the world we want? If we knew the ending, well, would we strive so hard? If we knew there was no hope, we might give up. It's the not knowing that keeps us striving and working so passionately, keeps us engaged. And I want to leave you with the rest of that quote by Arundhati Roy, some of which may resonate with some of you more than others. Our strategy should be not only to confront empire, but to lay siege to it, to deprive it of oxygen, to shame it, to mock it, with our art, our music, our literature, our stubbornness, our joy, our brilliance, our sheer relentlessness, and our ability to tell our own stories. Stories that are different from the ones we are being brainwashed to believe. The corporate revolution will collapse if we refuse to buy what they are selling. Their ideas, their version of history, their wars, their weapons, their notion of inevitability. Remember this. We be many and they be few. They need us more than we need them. Another world is not only possible. She is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. So that's the story. And I would like to open it up now to questions and discussion. And I'm aware that the first part of that quote, Arundhati Roy, where she says we should confront empire and lay siege to it, deprive it of oxygen, I resonate with some of that and not with others. But I do think telling our own stories and depriving those that are toxic to us of oxygen is a helpful thought. So can I open it up now for everyone else's ideas, please?
I just want to hear it again.
Oh, really?
Yes. I can't wait to listen to this again on the recording.
Oh, that's beautiful. Who
Thank
is speaking
you.
Now?
Gail.
Gail. Thank you, Gail.
Gail.
It's
mm-hmm.
rich, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
it's big.
We should tell it in all our partner groups.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that. Yeah, I think it's really a story for our time, and that's why I was actually originally thinking of just telling this story and then just discussing it for the whole hour. But yeah, I have recorded it on radio recently, but I may record it again. I'll see if I can get it for you, but obviously you can listen to it again on this on
yeah.
this conference recording.
What culture? What culture is it from again?
Tibetan Buddhist.
The what kind of Buddhist?
Tibetan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
That's okay. Yeah, you might not be able to hear me. I had a frog in my throat, and it came from northwest India.
Mm-hmm. Is it? This is Nayana. Is there a song that goes with the story?
I don't. I'll have to find out. I've been speaking to some old wise women. Well, they're not that old, but the wise women of deep ecology from around here who've been working with this story, who brought Joanna Macy out to Australia. And they didn't mention a song. They gave me an old text which had some long, beautiful poetic extracts. And a part of it was that I used in the very beginning was from that. So I've woven Joanna Macy's retelling with some of my own commentary and interpretation to try and unpack it as I tell it, whereas she tells it and then unpacks it a little bit more. But this part where I read, the earth would become wounded, her oceans and lakes sick, Fish would be born deformed and birds fall lifeless from the sky, forests and plain wither, and the survival of every single organism. Actually, except for that last line, that was an extract, but it was a long, it was like two pages of the prophecy of how, that was a longer prophecy, but two pages of it was just describing how the earth would become in 12 centuries from when they were.
Wow. Two-thirds through the story, you told about your opinion, and I thought you were done with the story, and it was interesting.
Yeah.
Could you explain
I know. It's not how you'd normally do it, and I did that because my friend Ashana, who wrote Drayality, when I did a practice telling with her and with the Drayality community, and I told it like that, and then I told it a second time in her hearing, and I left out that commentary. She says, I really liked it when you talked about how you felt about the word warrior, but I'm aware that it does pull you out of the story.
But I liked it.
You liked it?
I did like it.
Oh, yeah, cool. Thank you. Any other thoughts or feelings, even better?
One thing, this is Elisa, you spoke about the necessity of hope.
Mm.
And I forget exactly the wording. It was really moving to me, though. It's the importance that, the story isn't finished.
Mm.
And we don't know. I mean, that's the beautiful flip side of imagination that you're talking about, is we have to keep that alive. And I know, the last couple of weeks when people were defending Trump's decision not to stay in the Paris climate talks, all these people saying things like, well, it really doesn't change, it really hardly helps at all, and I just had such a feeling of, but it helps some, and it moves us together, and just this idea that anything is good, and that I'm sure that reminded me of that, and the importance of focusing on, we need to do what we can,
Absolutely. It's part of a process. Like the Paris Climate Summit was part of a process, a journey. It was significant in terms of getting people to agree to something, even if it was inadequate, and even if they're actually not, scientifically speaking, that people are not actually accounting properly, so we're not on track to keep it yet. But it was a step in the right direction, I agree.
Yeah, and just that maybe speak more to that whole idea of imagining, that what happens with Joyality and the helping people to imagine, what's possible, and that it is true. You need to be able to imagine things to bring them into fruition.
Yes, exactly. I remember hearing a corporate teller talk about how useful stories can be when people are afraid of change, and you can tell a story to paint a picture so vividly. We've all probably experienced it as storytellers. When you listen to a story, you feel like you've actually been to that country. So you've been to India, or you've been to Africa, or you've been to that faraway mystical place, and it lives vividly in your imagination. So if you can paint a picture of a future scenario of where you're asking people to move towards, that's reassuring, and they can imagine it, then they can more safely step into that or step towards that. Whereas it can be, just a reaction of fear towards any kind of change, not understanding that there's no choice. Like, change is going to come whether you like it or not, and it's going to be brutal. Or are you going to redirect it into a more positive and constructive and regenerative direction?
So, Jenny, this is Gemma, and, so much comes to mind as I'm hearing that story, but when you just said that about, as we hear these stories and we visit those places, I think part of the power of story, especially when we're talking about, these environmental issues or, places of change, is that it blurs the line between what is perceived as fiction or myth and what is real. And when you talk about, as you were sharing that story, to me, I'm reminded that, our native people, our indigenous people all over the world have prophecies, And they have their version of Shambhala warriors that are active now. They're an active presence. They look like, as you say, you know, attorneys, doctors, you know, scientists.
Yeah.
But they are, you know, trained in a way that is, or storytellers, they are trained in a way so that they are, you know, speaking to that disillusion of the myth. And the myth is, you know, that, that you know, the myth is about the way that we understand power, the way that we understand our disconnection from the earth. And so I'm reminded of all of those things and the way that, you know, even us as storytellers are, you know, a kind of a warrior, you know, in that way, and that we're breaking down that illusion. And
I
just wanted to share about all of that and just reminding, you know, people that in some places, these are not myths. These are very much, you know, part of people's realities today.
Absolutely. Thank you for pointing that out. Because the only ones like that, I'd love to hear more from you. Or if you, we're running out of time, but if you send a link maybe through the listserv of your reference of it, so if it's appropriate to share them. I've heard of all sorts of albino, like the white buffalo and the white whale and the white, you know, our Aboriginal people had a prophecy about the white whale, and I'd heard that there was, you know, many Indigenous cultures that talked about it as a shift in times as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's a friend, well, he's not really a friend, but he's someone I've connected with online again from Sydney, called Kenneth McLeod, who's written a lot about the age of transition. And he talks about the four interacting things that help the shift that it's not possible to have without all four things changing. You can't just change the economy. You can't just change one aspect of it. And so he talks about psyche, the existential new ways of being, so social learning and deep democracy, mythos in the way that we tell stories, rituals, the arts, you know, our songs and our dances, how they celebrate new ways of making meaning, and then the episteme, which is the rational new ways of knowing, complexity, interdependence and adaptive intelligence, and then techne, which is holistic technologies, distributed systems and eco-social reliance. So you know, new technologies as well as, you know, new ways of farming, or they're really going back to old ways of farming is what the science is pointing us to. So that the four interlock, and our job is as storytellers in this beautiful image that I'm looking at, which I can share with you, is, you know, we're a quarter of that, the storytelling, the shifting of the mythos, the shifting of the story. The other thing that comes through Joyality is, which is, I think, via Joanna Macy, is the three stories that we hear. Dominantly, we actually hear two. One is that, oh, business as usual is working fine, don't worry, the sky's not falling in, it's all good, you know, we don't need the Paris climate, whatever. It's all good, you know, don't stress about it, just get on with it. The other one is that it's all going to hell in a handbasket, which Fran has talked about, that idea of, you know, pulling people back from the hopelessness and thinking, well, what's the point of me doing anything because everything's, it's too far gone anyway and my little bit's not going to help. So that's another reason to not do anything. And then the third story is what, you know, what you're talking about with the Shambhala warrior stories that are really widespread amongst cultures that have retained their wisdom and their deep knowing and their connection to earth, which is about the transition, which is about the shift. Other people call it the shift, which is about that shift back from. And of course, this is not the whole world. Of course, this is the Western world, the Western culture that's dominating things at the moment. The Indigenous cultures don't need to have this shift because they're already there. They have to, you know, they're just powering up, as we see in the I forgot the name, the big oil fight with the river. What's it called? That your American
Standing
Indian people
Rock.
Have been fighting. Standing Rock, thank you, yeah. And it was great, you know, we felt this real solidarity because at Bentley, as far as we knew, we were the first ones that had talked, and it may not be true, but, you know, in Australia at least, we were the first ones who'd coined the word protectors rather than protesters and understood the value of naming. We are not protectors, we are protectors. and we are nature defending itself, and that Standing Rock also used that, you know, maybe that's an ancient thing that they've been doing. It was such a lovely feeling to go, yeah, we're protectors. Yeah.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying about storytelling. Like, I call it survival skill. That's what's keeping me connected to the deep knowledge. And like it's little pieces of threads. I studied with Joanna Macy, and I didn't understand. Oh. I went for a week, and I really didn't understand what she meant by systems theory, because it was so far. So I'm sort of working on that. But if I didn't know the old stories and the myths that we know, I don't think I could cope, because that's what.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. It's soul food, hey? It keeps us connected. I see it like a tree, like we're connecting to our ancestors. You know, we're connecting to the heavens and the earth, and the stories tell keep that connection flowing.
We sort of have trouble getting young adults to come to story things or to song organizations. So I think maybe if it's called a survival skill or some it's shown in some way that it is for everybody, that it might help.
So, sorry, did you say you find it hard to get people to come along to story concerts and you're thinking of renaming it survival skill?
I belong to the song, some folk song organizations and the storytelling organization, and we just don't get very many young people. It's they're more attracted to the technology and to what's happening. And you know, it's like we're doing it to the choir. So,
yes, I know. Yeah,
I like
that. And that's
that,
where
a
I'm hoping this experiment of.
Yeah, I tell the environmental story. I call them organic stories, but I call it a survival skill because it is necessary. It's essential.
Yeah, totally. It is. Yeah, good. Yeah, I hadn't thought of calling that either. But yeah,
survival.
In so many ways. To
That's
promote
such
survival
a good,
skills.
I like survival skill stories.
Oh, good. I'm glad you like it. I used it before. I have learning disabilities, and so the stories helped me be able to cope and read and understand, content. So it was a survival skill for me for a long time ago.
What is your name?
This is Nayana. It's Nayana Susan Tobin. I'm in Boston area.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Maya.
And I'd love to talk to people more about it because we have to, Joanna Macy says that we're going to survive because we just are going to, but
because
we're willing to go back that far and see how hard it's been.
Yeah. Does Fran have any comments? If she's still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, Fran.
I had heard you mention the Shambhala Warriors before, so I was glad I got to hear it.
Thank you.
And
yeah.
Which story of Laura's was it that you...
She calls it the Most Beautiful Bird, and I call it the Bird with the Most Beautiful Song. It comes from the Mbuti people from the Ituri forest in the Congo. And there's a beautiful book. When I became interested in the story and wanted permission to tell it, she sent me to this book, which is called The Forest People, written by an anthropologist who went to live with these pygmy people in this jungle and to understand them. And the story is a part of their tradition. And... I can send you a copy, Fran, of the way that I've rewritten it, but you can also, I'm trying to remember, I don't think she's got a YouTube of it, but she's got a recording of it. It's on one of her albums about horses or something. Very beautiful. She it's quite a short story in the book, and she rewove it over, 14 years or something, and, extensively.
I'd love to hear it, too.
Yeah, maybe we should get Laura to tell that. And discuss it. because I think it's also another really a beautiful one in the way that I was talking about, you know, singing the song, telling the story and dancing the dance. That's the heart of it. It's about the importance of connecting to earth, having those rituals, being able to celebrate, you know, be really able to celebrate and be grateful and be humble to nature for all its abundance, its complexity. And, you know, we can never understand it fully. Science still doesn't completely understand it. Doesn't for all our smarts. You know, it's far more delicate and intricate than we can really track yet. Yeah.
One of the most beautiful things that's coming up in science right now is the increasing awareness of how no organism exists in isolation, about how the microbiome and how how plants are connected and signal to each other through the mycorrhizae and so forth, and it gives a different view of how all those things literally are physically connected.
Yeah, and that's a big cultural shift. That's a big shift for most people. Like, we're attuned to it, but it's a new shift for people to see things so connected.
And the delicacy of that connection. That's right. Like, there was a really beautiful metaphor recently. There was a very green festival about renewable energy and renewable systems and renewable economic systems here. Very thought-provoking. And so my friend and I, who went to Labyrinth, which I haven't mentioned yet because I know we're out of time, but we made a labyrinth in the chip bark around a massive fig tree. It's really beautiful. If you go to my Facebook page, Sacred Circles, you can see it. And I might put that in a link if I have to do a follow-up email. Anyway, as we were making, we were digging the tunnels for the labyrinth, for a three-circuit labyrinth in the chip bark that was surrounding it. The woman who is the caretaker of those grounds, our recreation grounds, showgrounds, came over and said, oh, I'm not quite sure about you making that there, because you're going to disturb, you know, put that chip bark there. And that was made from a nearby fig tree, which had been hollow, had rotted out, and had died. And then we put that one there because we can see the beginnings of a kind of a fungus, this tree. And this tree communicates to all the other fig trees. So if it communicates it to the others, they'll all get sick. And that's why we put this chip bark down. And we said, oh, we're sorry, we didn't know about that. We asked permission of Ella, and she said yes. And is it okay? And he said, well, as long as you put it back exactly how you found it at the end, I guess it'll be okay. But it was a really interesting experience of just how connected trees were, but also how vulnerable they are to our disturbance. It was a great reminder. I'm aware of, you know, it's not good to drive up on car roots, you know, tree roots and stuff with your car, but I hadn't really thought that just moving aside the chip bark around the base would make much of a difference.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Jenny, thank you very much. It is almost
past. Thank you so much.
So we should probably say night, but within a week or so, be up on the website, the last recording with Matt. What's his last name now? I'm getting too tired. Hopwood is up now, and if you missed that, of How Love Stories Can Change the World, it was so beautiful and moving. So please do check that out. And our next teleconference will be in September. We will be having Unawami Jean Moss at the end of the month. I think it's the 28th. And that will be a wonderful way to kick off our fall. So everybody have a good summer, and hope you'll consider joining Healing Story Alliance if you haven't already. And feel free to be in touch with us.
And we hope you can all come to Missouri to the National Storytelling Network Conference.
That's
to
right.
Kansas City.
Yeah, we have a...
Beam me up, buddy.
Can you come? I hope that everybody can come. Oh, it's going to be so great.
And if you do come on Saturday morning, this is Fran, Marilyn Kinsella and I are rooming together, and we are going to provide a light breakfast up in our room on Saturday morning so that people can get together and talk about environmental storytelling, particularly
Great.
Talk about the possibility of what it would take to put together a very affordable and low energy, easy to put together weekend retreat in your region, so that you can get together with your colleagues and share information and share support and build up environmental storytelling in your region.
Mm. Well, hey. Fantastic.
Mm. Thank you.
Beautiful. We will see you in Kansas City.
Sounds all wonderful. Right. We will click our red shoes together, hey?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. All right.
Bye.
Jenny.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for the honor
of
speaking with you.
Beautiful.
And thank you so much for all your feedback. And I'll send a little email with some follow-up just on the listservs once I get my computer back. I had that die yesterday, but yeah. Thank you. Lots of love.
Bye. Yeah,
thank you, Jenny.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Alisa, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Yeah, I just thought of, like, remember at the end of The Wizard of Oz, there's no place like home?
Oh, yeah.
Like, so beautiful.
Yeah. Such a great story.
That would be a good way to start stories of place.
Yeah, true. Yeah, could be.
Thank you. This was lovely.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I enjoyed myself too. Have a great day. Oh, no, have a great sleep. Oh, have a great day.
Oh, my God. Yes, thank you. And you have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I want to come see your whales. I haven't traveled much, just your stories. So I'm very intrigued to come. I will look for your information.
There's no place.
There's no place like my home. Mm-hmm.